Welcome to the Smart Energy Channel at Partech.net. I'm your host, Margot Gerritsen. And today we'll concentrate on wind energy. Wind energy is currently supplying only a small part of our energy needs, but it is really a rather attractive energy source with very low emissions and low space requirements, especially when you compare it to, for example, biomass crops. My colleague, Mark Jacobson, a professor in civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University, is a strong supporter of wind energy, and he has done extensive research into available wind resources, both in the US and overseas. I support his enthusiasm for wind, strongly. And as he does, I hope that we will invest heavily in this excellent alternative. In this talk, recorded at Stanford on October 11th, 2006, Mark shares his ideas and research findings with you. Enjoy.
Okay, so today I want to talk about probably too many things, but hopefully I'll compress them down. I'm going to look at the impacts of wind versus biofuels versus hydrogen fuel cell vehicles versus diesel versus gasoline on air pollution and climate. So it sounds like too much to cover. It probably is. But so I want to start out by looking at wind energy just to give you an idea of some of the resources. Well, but before I do that, what's the motivation for why I'm looking at this? I'm looking at it because I'm interested in the climate and health impacts of energy systems, because most energy systems are responsible, or most of the climate change and air pollution problems are a result of energy systems and air emissions from them. And so one of the areas of work I do is looking at computer modeling of climate. And from these modeling studies, and also it's somewhat consistent with what other people have found who do climate studies, the things that cause global warming are carbon dioxide, methane, other greenhouse gases. Then there are particles, such as soot particles, which may contribute to about 0.3 degrees Kelvin. These are changes in degrees Kelvin of temperatures. Well, then there's land use change. And from calculations I've done, I've calculated about 0.1 degree Kelvin of global warming, maybe less than that, maybe due to land use change, specifically the urban heat island effect. But if you add all these numbers up, you'll notice that they're much greater than the temperature change observed to date. And part of that's because, or the major reason, is because I haven't accounted for the cooling particles. Most particles in the atmosphere are cause cooling of climate because they're reflective. Black carbon is a type of particle that causes warming, which is, black carbon is the main component of fossil fuel soot. But the cooling particles actually offset a lot of the global warming by about 1.2 Kelvin. And that would indicate that if you actually clean up air pollution particles, you're going to see a lot more global warming that you see today than you've seen today. And just to give you an idea, the net effect of all this is the observed global warming, which is about 0.75 to 0.8 degrees Kelvin. So if we clean up these cooling particles, which we're trying to do, although in developing countries they're increasing, we'd expect global warming to accelerate even more. Now, so there's a climate problem and there's also an air pollution problem. By the way, 2005 was the year with the greatest increase of CO2 emissions over the last 250 years. So although we've had energy efficiency improvements and implemented some renewable energy, CO2 is just skyrocketing. It just keeps going up and up and up. Partly because there are just so many more people and people are using more energy, and the emissions controls are really, the emission changes have been very small to date. So I feel that we, and you'll hopefully get this result at the end of this talk, that you really need a large scale elimination of emissions rather than these piecemeal reductions of emissions, and that's kind of the motivation of this talk. So let's look at how could we satisfy all energy demand worldwide through renewable energy, first of all, or can we? Well, the global overall power demand in terawatts is about up to 14 terawatts. Now, the potential renewable availability, when I say renewable availability, I mean clean renewable energy. And these I refer to solar energy. So solar energy, there's 1,700 terawatts available. That's when you actually, over land, and that's when you actually site the, you have enough space between the solar panels so people can walk, et cetera, like that. I mean, this is not a feasible number that you can actually cover the Earth with, but it is kind of an availability accounting for the capacity factor of solar energy. Now, wind energy is something we've done studies on. We've mapped the world's winds, and we come up with a number of about 72 terawatts of wind over land at 80 meters. Now, there has been another kind of a geophysical approach calculation of the total available wind energy over land at that height of about 80 meters, so it's of about 80 terawatts, so it's relatively consistent. Now, geothermal, and Roland could probably correct me, but this estimate from Stacy and Davis is about 9.5 terawatts, hydroelectric about 6.5 terawatts, wave power 5, and tidal about 3.7. But of these, so wind and solar can deal with this total overall power demand, and the electric power demand is about a fifth of this. So this is total, including vehicles and not only electric power, but everything else. So wind and solar can do it, but you'd want to integrate all these renewable energy sources to really address this problem. So how much wind capacity, which I'll focus on here, how much wind capacity has been installed worldwide? And Germany so far has about 18,500 megawatts installed, Spain 10,000, the US 9,000, India 400, then Denmark. And the world, as of the end of 2005, about almost 60,000 megawatts of installed capacity. And this is growing, but it's still a pretty small portion of the total electric power, even the electric power supply. If you just do back of the envelope calculation, assuming each turbine is about a megawatt, that gives you about 60,000 turbines, and this number I'll use in a little bit. In 2006, this is the interesting thing. The projected U.S. installations of electric power, well, natural gas, they're about 10,000 megawatts projected for 2006, and wind is actually second, 3,000 ahead of coal. So there's actually going to be more wind installed. Actually, this will be the second year in a row there'll be more wind installed than coal and oil for electric power in the United States. And that's from the EIA. Okay, so wind power for electricity. Let's just do a few back-of-the-envelope calculations here. If we wanted to satisfy all electric power worldwide by wind, well, the global electric power demand is 1.6 to 1.8 terawatts. This is maybe a couple years old, but it's not too far. Well, the average wind speed from this global wind powering study that we did, Christina Archer, who is a postdoctoral student here, did most of the work for this. The wind speed at 80 meters height offshore, we calculated, was about 8.6 meters per second. And there are now 5-megawatt turbines and even larger turbines. How many 5-megawatt turbines and 8.5 meters per second wind would you need to satisfy this electric power demand? And it turns out it's only about 860,000. And I say only because I mentioned we already have 60,000 turbines up worldwide. Now, these are smaller. So you need just over factor 12 to 15 more turbines, but there are larger turbines to satisfy this electric power demand. Now, one way to do it is to put them all offshore. It turns out because you do get the average wind speed offshore here is 8.6 meters per second. And so what percent of the water within 25 kilometers of the world's 1.6 million kilometers of coastline need to be shallow and windy? And that's accounting for the spacing between turbines. And that would be about 0.9% of all the offshore area within 25 kilometers. Now, these are kind of just fun numbers to play around with, but they are, if you think about it, it does indicate that there is some feasibility of powering the world through wind energy, but you'd want to, because of other issues, we want to integrate all sorts of other electric power sources and energy sources. Now, if we look at all energy, 9.4 to 13.6 terawatts is the power demand. So how many turbines would you need in this case? About 5 million. So we've ramped it up by another factor of six or so. Okay, so over land, the global wind power available, as I mentioned before, is about 72 terawatts. So you could satisfy this all over land and not necessarily even have to go over the ocean, although you'd want a combination of the two. Now, so there is, just to summarize this, there's enough wind for 40 times the there's enough wind available over land for 40 times all the electric power needed and 6 times all the energy needed. Now, this is a kind of a map of bathymetry, courtesy mostly of Mike. Where's Mike? Over here, Mike Dvorak. So he mapped the bathymetry out here off California's coast, and the blue areas are water depths less than 50 meters. Now, current technology are comfortably in depths of about less than 30 meters, but 50 meters is pretty close. And pretty soon, it'll be up to 80 meters, it's suspected. So there is anywhere along the coast, you can find areas that are shallow, especially if you go down, say, Catalina, some of these islands down here, and the backsides of islands, there's good places. This is a diagram showing not only the depth of water offshore, but also where the transmission grid is. And it shows these lines here are kind of indicate, these are different distances offshore. 10 kilometers from the coast is the first red line, for example. Now, in California, it turns out you can satisfy all electric power demand from fossil energy, which is about 50% of total electric power demand in California, with about 6,200 turbines, 5 megawatt turbines. You can replace all fossil electricity, including all natural gas, all the coal, which is not a lot, and all oil, and any other fossil wood and things like that, right, biomass, with about 6,200 turbines. Now, these turbines, so there are currently about 1,900 turbines in California, so that's only a factor of 3 to displace all the electric power. Now, if you want to go further offshore, there are some ideas for putting turbines that are suspended from the water and attached to the bottom of the ocean. And so this is a proposal from MIT and NREL for kind of 30 to 200 meter depth turbines. So this type of technology I don't think is that far off. It's right now there's a limitation of up to 30 meters depth, 30 to 50 meters depth, but this I don't think is too far away. Okay, so I just want to give you an indication of where the winds are fast. This is from our wind mapping study of the world. In Europe, you can see most of the fast winds are along coastal areas in northern Europe, although Spain actually has a lot of wind, but see, this is the way we got these data are from several thousand surface meteorological stations and about around 1,000 vertical profiles of wind. And so each of these dots represents the wind speed at an exact location and up to at 80 meters height. So there are a lot of areas where we didn't have data, and so there could be fast winds there. In fact, a lot of these cases, there are fast winds in places we didn't have data. But this gives you a general idea of where the winds are fast in Europe. And one of the things we found for the US was that there are fast winds along the southern and southeastern coasts. Now, people who've lived there and who've been experienced a hurricane kind of know that already. But but actually, these mean wind speeds are averaged over a year, and hurricanes really don't affect them that much. And so it turns out that the mean wind speed at 80 meters is pretty fast. And this area of fast winds wasn't previously known. And actually, this area off California hadn't been quantified as well. It was kind of nice to find, well, in 2003, when we first looked at the US, the study came out on the US map. And it was reported that the greatest reservoir of previously uncharted wind power in the US may be offshore and alongshore the southeastern southern coast. But when it was released, there was kind of a rush by developers to gobble up the land near the coast of Texas. And so we were happy to report, well, first on October 24th, that Texas sold the very first lease for an offshore wind farm that will probably be the first offshore wind farm in the US, because the other proposed offshore wind farms off Long Island and in Nantucket have been stalled. But there's no red tape in Texas, so this one will probably go through. And they're very excited about it. So this was based on directly from the maps that we produced. And then on top of that, just more recently in May, the second offshore wind world, or the second U.S. offshore wind farm will be built off Padre Island, and this will actually be the largest wind farm in the U.S., which is kind of nice. Okay, so one of the issues with regard to wind is that it's intermittent, or people argue that it's intermittent, and so it can't be used as baseload power like, say, nuclear or coal or geothermal in some cases. And so what we did was a study to see, well, you know, what's the, how can we quantify this intermittency? What's the effect of linking the wind farms together? Well, it's somewhat known that if you link wind farms geographically disperse intermittent energy together, you can reduce the intermittency, but we wanted to kind of quantify this. Well, and a coal-fired power plant in the U.S., the average coal-fired power plant is up 87.5% of the hours of a year. There's a forced outage rate of about a little over 6%, and an unforced outage rate of a little over 6%. They add up to about 12.5%. So this is the reliability of a average coal-fired power plant in the U.S., 87.5%. So what it's saying is that if you interconnect these wind farms, you can guarantee 33% of the hours of the year will be at the same reliability as the energy coming from a coal-fired power plant. Now, so that's one way to firm electricity from a wind farm. So there's another benefit of aggregating the farms is that you reduce the transmission requirements. Okay, now people complain about birds in wind, that wind turbines will kill birds. Now, let's just look into this issue in some detail. In the U.S., about 10,000 to 40,000 birds a year are killed by the around 1,900 wind turbines. So you think, okay, that's a lot. And it might be to the person who doesn't look at the other statistics. So if we look at transmission towers, there are about 50 million birds killed per year in the U.S. And buildings are, you know, another huge number. Cats are at least 50 million. Bird deaths in 2005 worldwide from the avian flu, there were 200 million. But if you extrapolate the bird deaths with 860,000 turbines, which is the number of turbines you need to power all electricity worldwide, you get about 1.2 million a year, which is still much less than the 50 million from the U.S. transmission lines per year. Extrapolated bird deaths with 5 million turbines is still around 7.1, and even if it was double that, it's still less than those from transmission lines. And if you compare that, because when you nobody wants to add a new electric power source or, you know, any type of new structure to the environment, but you have to think of you're displacing something else. So if you displace fossil fuels and biofuels, which kill 50 to 100,000 people per year in the U.S. prematurely due to cardiovascular disease and respiratory disease and complications from asthma as well, the benefits of converting to wind compared to the benefits, the costs of not converting are pretty significant. So the effect of wind turbines and birds basically will always be trivial relative to the benefit of reducing fossil fuels and biofuels on human and animal illness. So these numbers, the 50 million per year came from the Bird Conservancy and San Jose Mercury News, and the deaths are 50,000 to 100,000 are from a scientific study. Okay, so let me just jump to the conclusions here. There are sufficient wind and solar power available worldwide to supply all electric power, non-electric power energy sources, and to solve air pollution climate problems simultaneously. One-third of wind can be smoothed by interconnecting wind farms. Additional wind can be smoothed with or added to solar, hydro, geothermal to balance the load. So you can imagine if you have even an intermittent source, if you have something like hydroelectric power, it can be used to smooth out the flow of energy. A remaining intermittent wind can be used for hydrogen fuel cell vehicles and electric vehicles. So thank you very much.